Good evening again, everyone. It is now January of 2018. It's a new year, according to the Gregorian calendar, if you're, you know, Eurocentric like that. And this is the None of the Above show. This is your host, Laika Rose. We are still at the 7 p.m. time slot, but that may change. So I would encourage everyone who likes to listen to the show, if you have Twitter, please follow the Twitter for the show where I will tweet any important news. And that is None of Aboves. So you just take the out. And that's November, Oscar, November, Echo, Oscar, Foxtrot, Alpha, Bravo, Oscar, Victor, Echo, Sombrero. And you can follow that on Twitter. And you can also follow me. I usually will tweet about this shit. My Safe for Work account is TS Lyca, TSLYCHA. So, Happy New Year, everybody, if you celebrate the Gregorian New Year. And this is a show about everything non-mainstream. And I'm super excited because I have another trans guest on the show, but someone who has a little bit different background than a lot of my previous guests. So I think that's pretty cool. And I'm really excited to have her on. So her name's Valerie Woody. Valerie, would you say hello?
Hello, everyone.
How are you doing today?
You know, not so bad.
That's good to hear. I was actually like, I'm super nervous right now because So I got stuck in some really horrible traffic. Apparently there were 3 car accidents on like a road near my house and on the way back. So I like kind of just ran in the door and then had to like try to like get stuff ready for this real, real quick. So we'll see how it goes, but I think we should be okay, right?
I think we can get through it together somehow.
Yeah. We'll manage it. So would you like to introduce yourself a little bit to get us started?
Oh, sure. Well, my name is Valerie Woody. I'm from West Virginia. I've lived here my whole life and plan to stay here, unlike most of my friends. I transitioned, 6 years ago now. I used to be married. I have an interesting variety of interests, from space to philosophy and religion. I have a hard time not being brutally honest with people, which gets me into trouble sometimes. And I generally like to think of myself as a professional troublemaker. You know, I think causing a little bit of good trouble every now and then is a good thing, especially when it comes to lawmakers that want to legislate our rights away.
That's a very good point. That was like a lot of my motivation for being into punk rock as a teenager, and I didn't realize that it was effective as an artistic medium, but not necessarily the most effective unit for political change. But, you know, when you're a teenager, those things are not always as apparent as they might be at other times.
Raging against the system can be kind of its own thing, you know. A little bit of catharsis never hurt anybody.
Yeah, that is very true. Catharsis is an absolutely important thing for the human psyche, and it's something that, you know, the Greeks knew, and they involved that in their drama that they did, because it's the human psyche is a very interesting thing. Just the way that people's emotional states will change, and almost kind of it seems like people kind of get stuck in their thinking or their emotional states, and being able to have sudden drastic release can actually be a really critical thing for people being able to change their ideas, change their belief structures, change how they feel about the things in their environment, change how they feel about themselves, and form more positive goals. So it's actually like a more useful thing than just, you know, you might think from initial observation.
Well, you know, especially in these times, 2016, 2017, and probably 2018 have been pretty difficult for a lot of people on the margins. So I think, you know, it's easy to sort of dismiss, you know, a raging punk rock show with a bunch of kids as just sort of a diversion. But honestly, you know, I was at a house show 2 weeks ago, and, you know, seeing this great trans punk band from Pittsburgh called Hetward. Shout out to them.
Ooh.
And yeah, and they're a great group of gals. And you know, that genre of music has never really been my thing, but hearing lyrics and, you know, a band fronted by people like me, really can be a very unifying thing.
Right.
I was surprised at the kind of feeling I got going to the first one of those house shows here locally, because I never was that punk kid. I've been more the nerdy kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was always one of those, like, among the nerds, I was the one listening to punk rock, so I was kind of weird. And then among the people, like, you know, who are, like, listening to punk rock and, like, sneaking cigarettes and stuff, I was always the one talking about, like, multivariate calculus. So I was the weirdo there.
You know, I think maybe there are some times and places where those things, those Venn diagrams cross over. I guess yeah. You just weren't in that crowd.
Yeah, maybe not. Not till college. So I wanted to, like, I don't know. I guess I wanted to hear about your trans journey, and I think maybe the fact that you just mentioned going to that house show, and I'm now thinking about a Bad Religion and Against Me show, and Against Me, of course, is fronted by Laura Jane Grace, who's a punk rock musician transitioning in the public eye, and what that experience at that show was like with a lot of trans people at a big punk show, which was really kind of cool for me to go to that. So I'm now thinking about that. And then the next thing I wanted to ask you was kind of about your journey as a trans person. But if you can tie that kind of in to, like, maybe the sense of community that you got at that house show, that would be really interesting.
Well, that's kind of, you know, the end of the journey, or at least, you know, the point where I'm at now. Finding community is really difficult, especially in West Virginia. West Virginia is a state that's very impoverished. It's kind of geographically difficult to get around for some folks. So finding community with other trans people has been a challenge. College campuses has been a locus where people kind of find each other. But right. There hasn't been any coherent organization. We don't really have that critical mass. We're only just now getting there. But surprisingly, there was a study that was released last year, I think, by the Williams Institute, which is a institute at UCLA, that was estimating the population of trans youth by state. And they ranked West Virginia as having the highest proportion of transgender youth in the nation.
Oh, wow.
Which surprised a lot of people other than me. You know, I've run into an enormous number of young kids recently, with some with supporting parents, some with not without. And there's a great need here. So my journey has been kind of, at a young age, like a lot of people, I didn't know what trans was. I'm 32. So when I was coming of age in the mid-90s, there wasn't as much awareness about transgender people. And I still distinctly remember channel surfing and finding some kind of documentary on transsexuals on, I think it was TLC, back when the TLC was actually the Learning Channel and not the Honey Boo Boo and...
Right, I remember, so yeah, back when TLC... Uh-huh, I remember that.
Yeah, they had physics documentaries.
I was a 90s kid, too, so...
Right. So that experience of seeing that documentary was absolutely transformative for me. And two different things kind of stuck with me from it. One, I was pretty sure that I was trans and I finally had a word and a context for what I was feeling and going through. But I also knew equally in that same moment that it was not going to be easy and it was something that I should not want to be. You know, right. It was clear, the message was clear that my life was going to be hell, you know, because especially back then, documentaries were very focused on sort of the struggle and the medical aspect and kind of all very lurid and mm-hmm. sort of like, we're picking in on this secret world of trans people, you know.
Well, you can't have an expose without something to expose, so.
Exactly. Well put. And so I went through a lot of years doing what a lot of people do, which is trying hard to be for it to be anything else. You know, oh well, I'm just a crossdresser. Oh, I'm bisexual. I'm gay. I'm any number of things. You know, any number of outlets. Until eventually, I was only left with one conclusion that I had to be trans. And so that was around 2010. It took me two more years to really kind of come to terms with it and decide to transition. Started that in late 2011. And unlike a lot of folks in this situation, I was married to a cis woman. And we had been married for 5 years at that point. And she was extremely supportive. I think the main reason that it didn't end our marriage, and it has since ended for other reasons, but the main reason that it didn't end our marriage, I think, in our case, was simply the fact that she happened to be bisexual, so it wasn't a problem for her to all of a sudden be married to a woman. Okay. I think gotcha. In most other cases, you know, if you have a cisgender heterosexual partner, it doesn't really tend to work out for, yeah, I think, mainly that reason.
I had a bad experience with someone I was dating that when it became clear to me that I was trans and I really wanted to transition, it was like a nightmare for her, because she couldn't see herself being with a woman. And it was just really difficult. And eventually it was one of the things that destroyed our relationship, even though we were involved for like close to a decade.
Well, and that's really unfortunate. I'm sorry to hear that. But
oh,
I mean,
no worries. It's learning experience. So.
Right, and it sounds like you both kind of are better off given that, those circumstances.
Yeah, I would say so. I can't say I hear from her now. It didn't end on the best terms, but I definitely know a lot more about myself. And a really critical thing, and we'll touch on this a little more later because there's stuff I'm going to hit on, is that it really taught me a lot more about knowing what I want and being able to communicate that to a partner. And I can't say I've gotten too much better at it, but I've gotten decent enough at it that I feel like, you know, now at 33 years old, I'm finally ready to actually date people, you know, in a realistic way. And I've been doing it wrong for half of my life now or more. You know, and I'm finally like ready to actually date people, you know, in honest, like, here's who I am, this is where I'm going, and now I want to find out about you and spend time with you, and have it not be some kind of chaotic or dramatic or obsessive or like love hate kind of thing like it always was. And so that I really got largely from that experience, because there was so much friction about some core issues. It was very much a learning experience in that sense.
Sometimes you have to learn things the hard way, and it's not the best, but boy, do those lessons stick with you.
So. Yeah. Failure is the most effective teacher.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. I may have partly stolen that from seeing episode 8 the other day. I'm not a big Star Wars fan, but like I did go see it with some people, and there was a similar thing that was said in the movie. So,
yeah, I could go on about Star Wars for a minute. So let's steer clear of that little.
All right,
diversion.
We'll steer clear of Star Wars. Save that.
We're
going
to end up in that. We'll end up in that ditch for a while, or Star Trek even worse. So.
Ooh, yeah. See, Star Trek, I actually used to kind of be a fan of. So. And I kind of lost interest as I got older, but like, yeah, we'll save those for another show.
That's practically my religion. I will say on that topic, though, since it is somewhat relevant, I've started a Twitter campaign recently, to get people to acknowledge the fact that the character of Jadzia Dax and Ezri Dax from Deep Space Nine is totally a transgender character, like the closest thing we're going to get to it anyway in Star Trek so far. Because, you know, this is a character that, you know, their best friend is calling them old man, you know, and we're talking about a beautiful, you know, 30-something woman. This is a personage, I should say, that has the memories of a previous life as a man. So I think that's at least somewhat relatable to the trans experience.
It's definitely relatable, because a lot of times I feel like I'm living a very young life in an older body than I would like, and also carrying around memories of a life that's mostly come to an end, but still kind of living on in some ways. But it's this really weird sense of like I'm carrying around pieces of another person inside of me. So that is definitely relatable.
Yeah, and I was going to touch on that earlier. I think it's so common to the trans experience to find ourselves kind of stunted, maybe, to put it harshly, or kind of starting over. Certainly when you go through hormone replacement therapy, that's a second adolescence in a physical sense, and right. I think often in a developmental sense as well.
So you had mentioned that actually your experience with the woman you were married to, in terms of you transitioning, was actually not too difficult because of her being bisexual. So was there, I'm kind of curious about that, because, you know, I had a different experience with the long-term partner I had. Did she go through a significant grieving process, you know, when, or were you well enough aware of your own gender variance when you began your relationship with her? There's a lot of people that I dated knew I was really not like a normal boy, but I didn't know I was, you know, a transgender woman until a little bit later in my life, when I finally became more cognizant of what was causing my variance from normal genderedness. So I'm kind of curious about like what your experience was like in terms of, you know, did she have a grieving process or anything like that, like a lot of people talk about? Because I know my family has gone through a bit of a grieving process with me transitioning.
Right. So with my ex, she really, there was some coming to terms with, but I wouldn't put it in that same framing as grieving, because I think I heard from her so many times prior to that, "Oh, you're just the most sensitive man I've ever been with, and you're so different, and you're so," and all these other like things that are like, and that kind of
ties those should have been signs then, right?
Right, signs that you're dating an egg. And you know, I can tie that also into, I've been thinking recently about, you know, when I was a kid and being bullied for being sort of effeminate, and which led to me sort of trying to repress some of those behavioral tendencies, and then later having to unrepress them, which was difficult. I think it's interesting to think that those kids, despite not really knowing what they were seeing, were keying in on something that I wasn't even necessarily aware of, when they were calling me, you know, all these slurs and calling me a girl and things like that. And I don't remember who said this, but some brilliant woman on Twitter probably said something to the effect of, "Yeah, they used to tease me and call me a girl as if it was an insult, and then later in life, I became one." You know,
right.
It rings true. As for the grieving thing, so my mom, that was one of her first things she said. So I had got together a bunch of family members. I had traveled to where my grandmother was living at the time. And one of the first things the first thing my mom says, "This makes sense," which I'm like, "Thanks for telling me." And then she said, "You know, this, it feels like I'm losing my son." And, you know, she said that a couple different times over the next year or two. And that was really, really difficult to hear. But at the same time, in that same coming out moment, the context was, it was near my birthday, and so that was sort of like a pretext to be getting people together, and I'd almost completely forgotten about that. And afterwards they were like, "Well, we got you a cake," and I was like, "Yay!" And they were like, "It has the old name on it though," and I was like, "Yeah, it's okay." And then they brought the cake out, and they were like, "You know what?" And they took the spatula and scraped the old name off, which was nice. And then they all sang "Happy Birthday, Valerie" to me. And I cried.
That's actually really cool.
It was a beautiful moment, but that doesn't mean that my family is wonderful and accepting and perfect. You know, my mom had struggled with it for a couple of years, but I think she's super supportive now. Mm-hmm. At the time, you know, I already knew that my grandmother was suffering from dementia, and it's progressive. And I told her at the time, you know, I understand, you know, you're 80 something years old at this point. You're exempted from having to learn new pronouns, and you may not even remember. You know, that's a difficult thing. But, you know, my uncle later said some really unkind things. So it's a mixed bag. You know, I don't think anyone's coming out of experiences is usually all negative or all positive.
Right. Well, thank you for
sharing
that.
Where from here? Where to go from here?
Right. So, have you had any, like, issues with employers or anything based on being trans and transitioning?
I haven't had much employment the last few years, and a lot of that was just a depression. Mm-hmm. You know, and PTSD and stuff like that. Only in the last couple of years have I been on medication again and had it fairly well managed, you know, considering. Right. And I had a job this last year at an organization called the West Virginia Citizen Action Group. They were founded in the late 70s, kind of in response to the consumer rights movement that kind of Ralph Nader sort of kicked off.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a venerable progressive organization here, and they do a lot of different things. And I came on as an outreach coordinator and worked a lot on opposing the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare.
Right.
Lobbying senators, organizing people, you know, lobbying our state legislature on various things. And it was great to finally be doing activism and getting paid for it. Not much, but getting paid for it was nice. And I'm in between gigs right now, but right now I'm trying to do something similar. But I never really had a difficulty with an employer. I'm trying to think. No, I haven't really had any other experiences like that. Now we can talk about civil rights issues. I have, you know, the whole DMV story we can get into.
Yeah, and we are going to cover that because I really want to hear about that. So were you interested in, like, social issues and civil rights issues before you got involved with that group and had that, gig?
Oh yeah.
So how did that come about? Like what precipitated that, or how did that develop for you?
Well, my interest in politics it goes through my whole life. It's a through line. My grandfather was involved in state politics, and to an extent national, and it's just something that's always been discussed and kind of, you know, been in a household where the news was always on and the newspaper was being read avidly and topics of the day and controversy of the day were discussed. I remember going to a rally where Hillary Clinton spoke on the campaign trail for her husband in 1996. And that's kind of my first political memory. Well, I take that back. I remember the 92 election, too. But civil rights, especially civil liberties, have been an interest of mine. This started in high school. I was kind of interested in a law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Which still to this day
is a deeply problematic law, which allows companies to decide that you don't actually own the software or other devices that you own. You actually are leasing them, and if you modify them in any way or use them in a way that the company doesn't like let's say decoding DVDs, which is what the court case around this law was about.
DCSS and...
Right. Yeah, that was a whole thing. Mm-hmm. So I was writing to my congresspeople and, you know, writing term papers on it. The civil rights era has always been super interesting to me, and I kind of take that sort of as inspiration for my work. John Lewis, who now is a congressman from Georgia, was the leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and they organized the Freedom Rides to the South. There's actually an excellent graphic novel, three-part graphic novel called March about that, which focuses on his participation in the march from Montgomery to Selma that Martin Luther King led, and which was broken up by police, and John Lewis was, his skull was cracked, and he was severely beaten and nearly killed by police. And those stories of bravery and self-sacrifice inspired me at a young age. So when the Iraq War started being ginned up in 2002, mm-hmm. That became the focus of my activism for a while. I was also kind of a secularist activist. We had some kind of gray area church-state violations happening in my school, like moments of silence over the intercom and things like that, that I was involved in kind of opposing. It's just something that I can't keep away from. And it's kind of had different levels of priority in my life over the years. Mm-hmm. But even when I was my most depressed, I would still, if I could find time to, make the phone call or write the email to the legislator or whatever.
Yeah, that's, I guess I kind of like, I always found that stuff interesting, but kind of veered away from it and went more into academic and artistic stuff. So I don't know. I'm kind of tempted right now to ask you your thoughts on Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump comparing penis, button sizes, but maybe we'll stay away from that. I'm not sure that's a good topic to really, really get into.
Well, what is there to say other than Jesus fucking Christ?
Yeah, it's just mutually assured destruction played out in the media. And it can't lead anywhere good. The only potential decent outcome is if nothing comes of it. But
well, I will say though, I think Donald Trump sometimes has had this bizarre sort of counterintuitive effect in some areas of the world.
Right.
Kim Jong-un recently offered to resume talks with South Korea, mm-hmm. and they've taken him up on that. I don't know what Donald Trump has had any effect on that or not, but I think it's good that there's kind of, in some areas of global policy, they've kind of given up on waiting for the United States to do anything since we're in this crisis right now. Like the Paris Climate Agreement we pulled out of, and at the time there were only two other countries not in it. Us, Syria, and Ecuador. And Ecuador wasn't in it because they thought didn't go far enough.
Right.
And since then, Ecuador has signed on, and so is Syria, of all places. So we're alone in that. And the world has sort of kind of redoubled its effort to sort of say, well, the United States isn't going to do its bit. We're going to do even more of our bit. And, some states, like the state of California, the state of New York, have made commitments. I think that's kind of awesome. There's this weird sort of silver lining to this dark, shitty cloud of racism and nastiness that it has inspired a lot of people to get involved. I mean, I've seen a level of engagement and interest in being involved in politics here in West Virginia that just absolutely blows me away.
It's really cool to see people having this sense of like, oh gosh, well, some people need to start stepping up to the plate, because we can't just expect there to be good leaders taking care of this for us.
I think there's a lot of things that you could trace back to Americans being spoiled. I think anti-vax sentiment, for example, mm-hmm. The only reason we have a strong anti-vax movement in this country that's like, well, I don't need to give my kid the measles vaccine is because kids are not dying of measles all around them like they used to. And kids are not limping around on crutches or in iron lungs because they had polio. That's not a thing anymore because of vaccines. And we've been spoiled by that. you know, there are folks in sub-Saharan Africa that are lining up around the block to get the MMR vaccine because they know it can save their child's life.
Yeah, and there's actually cases, you know, here now where the rate of vaccination has gotten so low in some areas that there have been outbreaks of these things that we thought were, you know, more or less eradicated in the continental U.S. So that's kind of scary.
Yeah, it's this bizarre situation we have where right now everything is shit, but I'm hopeful that the crisis we're in is going to spur change.
Right.
I'm an incurable optimist, despite being very cynical. You know, I just don't know that there's any other option for us other than to try to cling to hope because, you know, what else are you going to do?
Yeah, absolutely. So is that part of what motivated you to get more involved in local politics? Because I know you've announced that there's a local office position that you would want to try to run for either this year or in the next term 2 years from now.
Yeah, I'm thinking about running for city council here in Charleston, West Virginia. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of a entry level position in politics. You know, I don't really have a deep resume or deep pockets or anything like that. But you know, I've come to think of things that would traditionally be considered weaknesses as strengths. Mm-hmm. People in West Virginia have a whole lot of struggle in their past. State is one that has been a resource extraction colony for the rest of the country since before it came into existence in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, definitely.
And there's this, I like to say that West Virginia has sort of a collective Stockholm syndrome, that we don't know anything other than coal companies and exploitation. So we just all we know to do is beg for more.
Right.
So that's, you know, our state went either the strongest or second or third strongest margin for Trump in 2016. It's a deeply conservative state with also one of the most impoverished states. Mm-hmm. We're suffering from the opioid crisis as the worst by far in the country. My town I used to live in, Huntington, famously had 30 overdoses on one day a couple years ago.
Wow.
People in this state are desperate. People want to leave. It's so common. And I feel like we're in a dark place, but I feel like we have all the things we need as a country to take care of each other. We have more than enough wealth to provide housing and food and healthcare to everyone.
Yeah.
And I'm hopeful that we're at a moment where people have just absolutely reached their limit. And people often ask, why in the world would folks in West Virginia vote against their own best interests, you know, as many believe they did when they voted for Trump? And I think it's not that they were necessarily doing that to the extent that they're aware. It's more that they've been failed by the system their entire life and going back generations. And they were just looking around for anything to sort of tear everything down. They saw a big orange Molotov cocktail named Donald Trump and chucked it right at that system.
And inadvertently, it may end up that you know, the fact that he is, I don't really like to criticize people too much, but I would say perhaps ill-equipped to be the leader of the free world, as the term is, you know, used, that it actually may end up doing that, but not in the sense that he was charging around saying during his campaigning. It's actually just bringing a lot of things to light through ineptitude, not necessarily through anything that he's accomplishing. So, interestingly enough, like, we actually may get some of those effects of, like, parts of the system come crashing down, have to be rebuilt, and can be rebuilt in better ways, but not because of anything that's happening due to the actions of the president.
Yeah, it could go a lot of different ways. We're in a really interesting inflection point right now. I kind of started that thought with saying, you know, there's a lot of things about me that I think would traditionally disqualify me for running for office. You know, I have mental illness, I have depression, PTSD, and anxiety. I haven't had a lot of work experience in the last 10 years because of that. I still struggle with those things. I'm transgender. I'm an atheist and outspoken about it. I am unashamedly polyamorous and sexual person. But I don't think that those things are weaknesses. I think they're strengths. I think diversity is increasingly being valued by at least some segment of the population.
Right.
And more than that, I think if we learned anything from the 2016 election is that there is nothing that disqualifies you from any office.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there really is nothing that, unless something is codified into law,
right.
Popular opinion can be swayed in ways that means that there's really no thing that traditionally would have been a disqualification is necessarily strictly a disqualification. And if you can, there are no laws
of physics and politics. Rhetoric,
make that actually work to your advantage, you know. And some people are really great at that verbal discourse, and they can take, you know, things in their past that usually their opponents would be calling them out on, and actually draw attention to those things and be like, hey, so this is why I'm uniquely qualified for this position. So if you can actually take that approach, that might really behoove you in terms of being able to get where you want to go.
Right. And I think people in this state in particular are just tired of, we have a lot of nepotism and good old boyism, and I'm sure that's true everywhere, but West Virginia kind of baked in. And mm-hmm. I think people are sick and tired of that. And they want to see someone who's been where they are. You know, I haven't really struggled with opiate addiction, but I have known so many people who have, you know, at least half a dozen friends and acquaintances have died.
I'm sorry poverty, to hear that. That's really awful.
It's okay. And, you know, poverty is endemic. You know, I grew up in a fairly middle-class background, and you know, since then, economic conditions have made it harder and harder. And you know, there were times where it was difficult to feed ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, people need somebody who's willing to listen, who's reasonable, who is actually open to changing their mind, who actually cares. And I think those are really the things that we're discovering are important. You know, experience is important. I agree. And I think this idea of looking outside of politics for politicians, especially for the highest office, is really wrongheaded. You know, if you're hiring someone for a job, you don't want to. The person with the least experience is not the person that's going to be at the top of your list. Mm-hmm. And this idea that career politician, you know, is some kind of pejorative, I don't understand, honestly.
That is a very good point. Like. Yeah, okay.
So but there's a few other topics we wanted to get to. I don't want to filibuster time about my political philosophy.
No, it's good. I actually was really excited to have someone who's qualified to talk about some more political and social issues on the show, because although I follow some of them, I don't really feel like I'm qualified to lead any discussion on them. But, you know, if I have a guest who actually is more knowledgeable than I, then, you know, the show can have an interesting discussion. So I'm actually really glad to have some of those topics. But if you want, we can kind of change paces from politics to poly. just chop off that last syllable there. You said that you're outspoken and unabashedly poly, and I'm a big proponent of polyamory, especially because what I've learned about relationships, polyamory not only benefits from but practically depends upon good communication skills.
Oh, absolutely.
So, and that's something that a lot of people, they look at poly as just being a slut. And I want to say, you know, there's nothing wrong with being a slut, and I'm totally a slut, and it's pretty much all you have to do is say hi and my pants will come off. But like, poly is, you know, it is a little bit different, and a lot of people don't understand the distinction, for one point, because, you know, it involves having romantic attachments to more than one person at the same time. And in order for people to not get, you know, hurt emotionally, you have to be not only kind of good at listening, but also good at communicating what you want and good at maintaining some balance and some independence as a person from the people you're involved with. And so those are all actually really good elements of human maturity, in my opinion. And so I would actually think that someone who's kind of this scandalous poly person is actually really good for a lot of things, because if they do a decent job of being poly, they actually have a lot of qualities that are very transferable to other aspects of their life in ways that can benefit the people around them.
Yeah, I agree. My experience started out being married to my ex in an open relationship, and I found that that style of relationship, you know, no judgments, but judgments, I feel like is kind of trying to avoid the reality of the situation. So I think it's inevitable that feelings are going to happen because we're human beings.
Right.
And trying to deny that or pretend having feelings is all of a sudden a bad thing is probably really unhealthy.
Yeah, there's some people who call, like, open relationships or certain styles of swinging poly light. Like, you can fuck other people, just don't get too attached, because then it gets really messy.
Well, and there are boundaries, and that's understandable, but trying to sort of act like, well, we can have sex without really having feelings, and it's just sex, is something you hear a lot. No, I'm sorry. Sex is a very emotional thing.
It's a very
intimate and personal thing, obviously. So, I think running away from the reality is never a good idea. Here's finally in a very odd place to work in a Mr. Rogers quote. But one of my favorite things to say in the last couple of years is a quote from Mr. Rogers. If it's mentionable, it's manageable. And I would add that if it's unmentionable, then it's out of fucking control.
Right.
I think... And that's been kind of a mantra for me. You have to be able to talk about this stuff. You have to be able to confront truths. Otherwise, they control you.
And there's actually something that I really like to get into on this show, especially when I have guests that are like cam performers or fetish models who are trans. Something I really like to get into is confronting like different aspects of fetish and kink. Because one of the big things that comes up in trans rights is like, you know, trans people on average are less likely to instigate some sort of assault in a bathroom. You know, we're not perverts. We just need to pee is kind of a rallying cry. And something that kind of gets dropped from that, and it's not, you know, it's not part of that topic, but it's going to come up, so it's a conversation that needs to be had, is a lot of trans people are kinky. And especially when you feel weird about your own body or your own genitals, sometimes you're going to look for other ways of exploring your sexuality. And so there's a lot of kinky trans people out there, and so I think it's really important to be able to like bring that out and have that conversation and make it clear like what it means to have fetishes and kinks in ways that are not pervy, not harmful to other people, and to be able to talk about that stuff too, because it's going to come up.
Well, there's a double standard. So
yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Our culture has come a long way from, I'm trying to remember the name of a Supreme Court case, and it's absolutely escaping me at the moment. But it wasn't long ago, you know, in the 70s, that sex toys were illegal. Technically they still are in Texas and a couple other places.
Right. You can have a limited number of personal massagers that you sell, but you can't market them as sex toys, and you can only sell so many of them. And yeah.
And you have to be married, and there's all these weird rules. Funny enough, Ted Cruz actually argued in favor of this law in an appeals court hearing, and argued that there was no inherent right to sexual pleasure, that could be a right that was regulated or controlled by the government, which is pretty weird for a small government conservative. But anyway, I digress. I think there's a double standard. You know, this is an absolutely terrible example of kink, but, you know, 50 Shades of Grey is kind of this become mainstreaming, and there's all these other cultural touchstones that, you know, if you're cishet, it's totally fine to have a little bit of spice in the bedroom, as they might say.
And but even the fact that 50 Shades of Grey is like really kind of horribly non-consent-y in a lot of ways. And yet that's still excused because it's a straight, normal relationship and they're monoamorous and other things like that. And as soon as you involve non-cisgendered people or non-heterosexual people or non-monoamorous people, then suddenly, you know, people suddenly act different. And that's that double standard.
Exactly. Well, and really what it comes down to is that to some extent, non-traditional sexuality is always viewed as pathological or aberrant in some way. When there's a same-sex kiss or same-gender kiss on television, that's still controversial. And right. It's seen as explicit or more sexualized than it is, or sexualized at all, when it can be completely innocuous. Considered innocuous when it's between a heterosexual pair. So I think our culture has a long way to go with sex, especially even for cishet relationships. There's a lot of shaming around, you know, women being called sluts if they have sex with more than one person. Or have sex for fun, maybe. You know, like, there's all these double standards out there.
Right, right. Doing a fun thing for fun, if you're female presenting, is seen as very different than if you're male presenting, which...
Boys, you know, are going to be boys! Right.
Yeah, and that's... You know, I know your profile also mentions that you're a feminist, and so that's a really interesting topic to get into. You know, when you're trans, because of the branch of extreme feminism out there, the trans exclusionary radical feminism, and then also the sex worker exclusionary radical feminism that you come across, that also wants to kind of constrict what is okay for women's sexuality.
I actually have a feeling that tomorrow night I may be confronting a little bit of that sex worker exclusionary stuff. There's going to be a public event... informational event about sex trafficking, which is often a euphemism for, which, you know, sex trafficking is a phenomenon, but there's a lot of campaigning around creating laws that would basically further criminalize sex work and sort of this bizarre view of rescuing sex workers from something that they're choosing to do.
Right. So doing like porn and sometimes dancing at a strip club and stuff like that, like, I'm totally okay with doing that. And, you know, it's like we were talking earlier that sex can lead to feelings, and the idea that something is just sex, you know, it is something to be cautious about. But like an informed adult who's making a choice to do things like that is an informed adult, and it's still regulated a lot more harshly than things like alcohol consumption that can have far worse effects on your life.
The sex work exclusive feminism take on that is that, well, there has to be coercion, and just the fact that money's involved means it's inherently coercive, which is true to the extent that, like, working in a fast food restaurant is coercive. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that that's really a compelling argument.
If you're going to say that, then anything with money can be looked at as coercive. And then
it's kind of funny because it ends up kind of like in a weird way, wrapping all the way back around to being misogynist, because you're sort of denying women the agency to make this decision themselves. You're saying, well, they can't. It's impossible for women to want.
Which is one of the original driving points for a lot of 1950s, 1960s feminism in U.S. culture. At least particularly among fair-skinned folk, is, you know, women's free agency in making relationship and career choices. And so then, like, by saying, like, so we're feminists, but it's not okay to do any type of sex work, is placing constraints on you know, career choices and relationship choices for women. And that just seems very strange to me, like why someone would want to do that.
Right. Well, I think we're in a place today where it seems like most real active feminists are kind of on board with the idea that women have autonomy and that trans women are women and things like that. I actually was recently appointed and asked to join the board of the newly reformed chapter of the West Virginia chapter of the National Organization for Women NOW, which is a venerable women's rights organization. It goes back to the late 60s and early 70s and the Equal Rights Amendment campaign and things like that. And I've found that a number of women who founded the West Virginia NOW chapter back in the 70s are still involved and getting it started back have been very welcoming to me and very knowledgeable about these issues. So there is kind of a disproportionate perception, I think, among trans folks. At least I get the sense on Twitter, where I spend way too much time, that there is this huge problem amongst mainstream cisgender feminists. And it really, I don't think, is the case.
Yeah, I think it's a vocal minority that really kind of, because trans women do have a tendency to be targeted by certain groups, whenever there's a vocal minority, a lot of us are going to react with a sense like, oh crap, it's another large group that's going to try to oppress and silence us, which is a valid, you know, feeling to have. But my experience has been that most people who label themselves as feminists are supporting of all women, you know, women of color, women of every social background, every place in the world, women of every religion, women of every body type, including whatever genitals you happen to have or have been born with.
Well, you know, I was going to say that I think a great example, a great barometer of where feminism is at is, you know, I was at the Women's March in D.C. a year ago, and I heard so many speakers get up on that stage and specifically call out, you know, and give support to trans women of color, the most, and you know, Native Americans, the most marginalized folks. I was really impressed by that. Even some of the you know, more stalwart old school feminists like Gloria Steinem have kind of come around. I really don't think it's as much of an issue as it is. I think TERFs really kind of, it's easy to get a lot of attention and yell and be loud.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're actually, like, we're coming up on the near the end of the hour. I had so much fun talking, but I kind of want to give you a few minutes to talk about your DMV story, because I know that's something you got mentioned in an article for, and so I'm curious, like, what all had happened.
Quite a few articles, actually. Back in 2014, over the summer, I had seen a news story come across the wire that two transgender women reported being severely harassed and discriminated against at DMV offices in West Virginia. And two separate incidents, two separate women. And in both instances, they were yelled at. Slurs were involved. They were called it. They were both told that they had to remove their makeup, wigs, and jewelry in order to have their photo taken for their photo ID. And they cited this policy that had been written like 12 years before. And, you know, and in one case, one of those women wasn't even wearing a wig. So, you know, it was a really difficult experience for them. And the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund based out of New York publicized it. And, you know, so I knew a couple months later I had to go to the DMV. I was going to get ready to go on vacation. I wanted to get an ID updated because I was going to be going to Colorado. I wanted to make sure and sample that newly legal medical recreational marijuana. And you need a photo ID for that. So I kind of knew what I was getting into going in. I went ahead and called Transgender Legal Defense and said, hey, I'm going in. Do I need to know anything? They were just like, good luck. And, so I recorded everything on my phone, audio, And, you know, I went in, everything was hunky-dory fine. They dealt with all my documents. You know, I was actually getting a learner's permit. I took the learner's permit test and passed it. All that stuff was perfectly fine, didn't have any issues, until I got to the photo-taking station when the gentleman behind the counter just sort of looked at his screen, squinted at it, looked at me, looked at his screen, looked at me, and I was like, is there something wrong? And I already knew what it was. Right. He was like, and didn't really say anything, ran off. Somebody else comes up, does the same thing. The next thing I know, I'm called out into the hallway. Six different managers are surrounding me, and then my then wife. And they tell me, listen, we have this policy. Here's this memo written by the transportation secretary all these years ago. You can't have your picture taken because you're impersonating the female gender. You're fraudulently misrepresenting your gender. I tried to argue against it. I even tried to get a copy of this memo, which they refused to give me. Yeah, that was interesting. And eventually, you know, I eventually decided I had to get this ID. It was really humiliating. I went and washed my little bit of makeup off, took my very small amount of jewelry off, and had my picture taken. And it was more humiliating and dispiriting than anything. It was very, very, it was odd being treated like literally a second-class citizen. And
yeah.
So I contacted Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund again, and over the next year, we collaborated, and eventually we filed a notice of intent to sue in federal court to the DMV and our attorney general, a transphobic asshole named Patrick Morrissey. And once we did that, all of a sudden, their tune changed, policy changed, and subsequent to that, the legislature actually introduced a very progressive gender marker change policy that now allows anyone in the state of West Virginia to have a correct gender marker if they only receive the signature of any physician, not even just an endocrinologist.
Oh, wow.
Which is one of the most progressive ID policies.
Here in Florida, your physician has to be licensed with the DEA for their signature to mean anything.
Well, that's true for any physician, actually. That's true for this particular thing.
Okay.
But it's still far more progressive than most places where it's impossible to get it changed unless your birth certificate gets changed.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I'm glad that actually ended up working out in the end. And it's really cool to hear that, you know, the more permissive legislation was introduced that didn't require specifically an endocrinologist. I want to say thank you again for coming on the show today. It was super exciting to have you. We will totally have to do this again. And maybe we can do Star Trek, Star Wars, and Sex Lives. That might be an interesting episode. Three S's. I don't know.
It's been my pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yes, thank you so much. And we're still at 7 p.m. for anyone listening. If you want to tune in next week, I should have a fairly renowned author on, like, sex workers' rights and that sort of thing. Assuming it doesn't get rescheduled. He already agreed to do it, and we have a date set. So that should be what's happening next week. So looking forward to that. And I will see everyone a week from now. Have a wonderful night. And up next is the flagship show, Slings, Flings, and Ding-a-Lings, broadcasting live again. Everybody enjoy that, and I will catch you all next week. Au revoir.